Hey, everyone, and welcome to the fifth episode of Forecast, a show about climate science and climate scientists. I'm Mike White. So if you've ever wondered what it's like to find a large volcano underneath the Antarctic ice sheet, this is the show for you. We're talking with Robin Bell from the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory and Columbia University. Robin's remarkably been at Lamont for over 30 years, pretty much her entire professional career has been there. And over that career, she's had a fascinating range of topics, mostly centered around Greenland and Antarctica. She's not only found that volcano in Antarctica with her colleagues, but has pioneered a lot of the major instrumentation techniques that we now sort of take for granted, a combination of laser altimetry and radar and aerogravity, kind of cobbled together in the early days and now more formalized in an observational platform that can be taken by aircraft to image the ice sheets from top to bottom. And during the course of that work, Robin's found all kinds of interesting things about the ice sheets, things like water moving uphill in the Gumbertsevs, and then large-scale ice freeze-on from below. People think about ice sheets as being built from the top down through snowfall and compression, and then ultimately turning into ice. But it can also form from the bottom up, and these kind of freeze-on processes can make the ice sheet fold and mix in rather surprising ways. And that's been an interesting challenge for the ice sheet communities to think about. She's also been active over the years with the NSF Advanced Program, trying to understand how women in science are recruited or are not recruited, and has worked a lot at Lamont over the years in trying to increase gender diversity. Robin talks about some of the challenges in the early days of Antarctic science, and it hasn't always been an easy career path to take, but things have fortunately gotten vastly better, it sounds like. And Robin comes at it now from, I think, a very optimistic perspective. So there's a lot of hope and optimism for in particular, women in science, but also still this great enthusiasm for what's happening now in Antarctic science. Thanks, and I hope you enjoy the show. Finally, as always, the viewpoints here are mine and those of my guest. Robin Bell from Columbia University and the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory is today's guest. Robin, thanks so much for being on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
In looking through your background and your out-of-office interest, I see that you have strong interest both in sailing and in flying, which kind of strike me as being similar versions of the same process, which is leaving the terrestrial environment, either in air or on the ocean. And I'm wondering, going back to your childhood, did you always have those kind of interests, or is that a new development for you?
Oh, my dad was a pilot. I mean, he was a lawyer as a job, but he always had a plane. So I spent a lot of my childhood sitting in the back seat of a plane, looking out the window. So I attribute it, you know, that to part of, you know, that being able to look at things from a distance and being able to put together stories by looking down at terrains.
Where did you grow up flying? Where was your father based?
I grew up in New Hampshire, and so there were lots of hills and valleys and mountains and roads, and he'd fly by saying, "I fly roads." So you'd always look for the pattern, and you could figure out where you were by looking for the pattern.
So he wasn't flying using any kind of an onboard navigational system at the time, I guess.
No, there wasn't really GPS. There were these great big paper mats that you'd unfold, and you'd sort of plot where you were going and look for the next directions. And you'd even look for, like, drive-in movie theaters, because they'd always be good hints for where you were, because you could see them from a long ways.
Did you go and buzz them during showtimes?
No. My dad was a little... My little sister's a pilot, too, and she would have done that, but not my dad.
Okay. Being a lawyer, he was a bit more law-abiding, I suppose.
Yeah, he was a little more law-abiding. He didn't want to get in trouble.
Was it a single-engine kind of prop plane?
Yep, it was. He had a bunch of different planes, but the one I remember the most was a Bonanza, so it was a single-engine kind of high-performance plane.
When were you first allowed to take the throttle?
Oh, he always encouraged us to fly because he always had this idea that anybody should know how to land the plane. So probably when I was 12 or 13, and then I soloed when I was about 18. And then I decided I couldn't fly for fun and sail for fun. And I was in love with a guy who sailed, so one had to go.
So the flying went for a while, but not permanently. So how close were you to the ocean at that time?
Oh, let's see. How close was I to the ocean? I went to college in Vermont, so that wasn't very close to the ocean at all. But after college, my boyfriend and now husband and I built a boat that we sailed and rowed down the Hudson River past Lamont and eventually to Woods Hole, where I got my first job because I arrived on a sailboat.
You mean you showed up for the job interview saying, I'm here, I'm on a sailboat, hire me?
No, it's even worse. I showed up for the job interview saying I might get there, I might not, because the sailboat I have doesn't have an engine. And if the wind doesn't blow, I'm not going to make it.
That takes a lot of guts. I mean, they could have just said, you could just rent a car instead.
Right. I guess they could have, but...
They said, this could be the right kind of person for us.
But actually, that's what I tell the young people. I said, you know, don't be afraid to be a little bit different.
Yeah. Just you got to be who you are, because you're going to be that way once you get the job anyway. So right. They should just know.
Right. And, you know, it's more interesting if you ride on a sailboat than in a rented car.
So you must have come to Middlebury in about 1976, is that right?
Right, right. I actually started in 77. I took a semester off between high school and college.
My friend Jack Schmidt, who's a fluvial geomorphologist, taught in Middlebury for a little while. And his take on it was that it was a beautiful town, but perhaps too beautiful that you couldn't really go out to breakfast without getting avocados with your eggs. Like you couldn't just go out and get a greasy spoon, sort of, you know, bacon and eggs kind of breakfast. Was it that kind of place then, or did it have more...
No, I think it was a little more. I think it's gotten more upscale as time has gone by. Vermont's turned that way from being more avocados, shall we say, than there were.
So back in the late 70s, you were studying geology. What was the program like in geology at the time?
As I say, in high school, I learned to love physics, and I thought physics was just an amazing way to look at the world. And then between high school and college, I took a class where I learned about plate tectonics and the magnetic stripes on the bottom of the ocean floor. And that meant you could use physics to understand how the planet worked. And that was just amazing, mind-blowing. I can remember standing in my great aunt's living room with a globe and telling her, she had to know about the stripes on the bottom of the ocean floor.
Did she agree?
Oh, she was, you know, she was an open-minded person, was willing to learn at, you know, the age of 75. She was game to learn about the stripes on the bottom of the ocean floor. So that's what I went to Middlebury, wanting to use physics to understand the Earth. So, you know, I got a good background on how to do research. I did a paleomagnetic thesis. I got to walk around and drill holes in rocks and spin little samples and figure out where the poles were and come up with a story about how the continents crashed together, which is probably wrong, but that's part of science, is learning to make stories and accepting that you might be wrong.
I think the amazing part, or one of the many amazing parts about plate tectonics, is the time lag between the amazing idea and, as you say, the geological application of physical principles to provide the support for that theory. I mean, it was a long delay. Did that kind of understanding at all affect your own sort of willingness to engage in risky scientific behavior? That might take a while?
Well, I think it was, you know, to me, that it was, I always think of what Walter Alvarez said, is that, you know, you might be lucky if you have three good ideas in your science career, and you got to get through those other 1,000.
That few.
Well, that's what he said, you know, and I always,
no, I mean, only 1,000 bad ideas.
Right, only 1,000 bad ideas. So I'm always telling my graduate students, you know, we got to get through those 1,000 before we get to the ones that are right. And that's what science is. It's this concept of testing ideas and putting them out there and figuring out which ones work and which ones were maybe a little dopey.
So just to play devil's advocate, you have, let's say, optimistically, 3 great ideas and 1,000 bad ones. The problem that I think I would have, and a lot of people would have, is how do you know which of those 1,000 might make it into the good idea category? Is it because if you just pursue them all to their end, you wouldn't get through 1,000. So what's your weed out process when you're going through the 1,000?
Oh, it's really interesting, because I, in graduate school, I probably, the one thing I got from my advisor, he and I had a challenging relationship, but that's all right. That's what it's supposed to be, was that it's important to pick the good questions. And I think if you're chasing the good questions, then that helps you focus on which are the ideas to focus on. It's making sure you're asking the right question about how the planet works and maybe looking at it in a different way than other people.
So spending more time on the initial conceptualization of the problem and perhaps less on the details initially.
Right, right.
And that's always the fun part about science, is that, you know, you can be sitting in your office or wherever and just with your eyes closed, and then you're actually working, and people will go by and I think, my God, what is Robin doing? She's not working at all. That's actually the hardest part of the job, isn't it?
Well, I think the hardest
not
part.
Not the is hardest part.
No, I don't know if it's the hardest part, but the hardest part, I think, is the fact that it can be so obsessive that it drives people in your life crazy. That you really would be happy to be thinking about it all the time. And there are other parts to life, and your brain does better if you don't focus on it all the time. So I think that's the hardest part. Is it worse?
Is trying to separate out a little bit of yourself or the other people in your life?
Right, right, exactly. Which is,
I think I met you back in, maybe it was 2010 when I was at Lamont, and that's one thing that really struck me about you was just the level of your enthusiasm for what you were doing. And is that a pervasive feature that you do have to sort of wrestle with?
Oh, yes, because anything I do, I'm going to do wholeheartedly. If something, it's not worth doing if it's not, if you aren't going to embrace it and do it the best you can. You know, that's probably why we in our family sail across oceans, as opposed to just sailing up and down the river. If you're going to do something, you might as well really do it.
Are you still sailing in the same boat that you and your husband built years ago?
No. We've moved up several times, having had kids, and now, when we were much younger, we thought we could go offshore in that boat, and now we're a little wiser.
Just on safety grounds?
Just on safety principles. It's like, we thought we were going to sail to the Bahamas, and that, really?
So you sailed up to your interview in 1980 to Woods Hole, and right. You were there for 2 years. What were you doing there?
I was making maps of the Gulf of Maine and then going out to sea and helping them collect data and realizing again how cool the physics were, but realizing that part of me really wanted to be able to tell the boat where it was going or design the experiment. At that point, I thought it was drive, you know, not be an Indian the rest of my life, but actually be able to direct where the ship was going and design the experiment is what became really important, really evident to me that I wanted to do, you know, if I was going to stay in science.
So immediately after your bachelor's, you recognized that you wanted to go back into grad school and be able to take control of your own ideas and research programs.
Oh, well, that was if I stayed in graduate school. I stayed in geology. You know, I, again, wanted to be with the love of my life. So we got married, and he was at Columbia. And it's like, well, okay, I'll apply to Lamont. I hear it's a good place. We sailed past it. and if I get in, great. Otherwise, maybe I'll go back to being a ski patrol or a computer programmer or something else. But I got in.
That's interesting because, I mean, looking at your CV, you came to Columbia in 1982, and you haven't left. So you've been there for two masters, a PhD, and then multiple levels of career progression. And just looking at that, I would have thought, wow, I mean, clearly Robin had a clear goal to go to Columbia and stay there forever. But actually, it wasn't that way at all, it sounds like.
No, it wasn't. It was, you know, it was the chance to come here was really because the way my personal life was involved, you know. Evolving. And part of the reason we're still here is that New York's such a great place to run two careers. And Lamont is just a phenomenal place to be as a scientist. So, you know, it worked both on the professional side and the personal side.
Do you live in the city and commute up to Lamont?
No, I live up near Lamont. So okay. I enjoy the bucolic life. We keep a cell phone up here.
Another thing that struck me when I was visiting Lamont is just sort of the boiling cauldron of ideas that are up there. And it seemed also not only to have this constant stream of ideas, but maybe a sense of competition, perhaps, or people being quite willing and eager to discuss ideas in a forceful way. Is that your experience there?
Well, again, that's discussing ideas in a forceful way is what I see as testing the ideas. And you much prefer to test your ideas and draw pictures on plates at lunch and share them there than share them in the review process. It's a much better way to sharpen and focus your thoughts and throw out those ideas that are dumb or not maybe quite mature, shall we say.
Right. So some of your early ideas, I don't know if these fall into your amazing discoveries or amazing ideas, was like your work in Antarctica on volcanoes and subglacial lakes. Were those some of the discoveries that you, like when you saw them, you were just amazed by them? Or were you like, oh, okay, I thought that would happen?
No, you know, the day we found the subglacial volcano is certainly one of those ones that is very much burned into my head, you know, because we'd been sort of struggling for 2 years to get what at that point was cutting edge technology, which was putting all these instruments on a single twin otter and collecting all this data at once. People had gone out and collected one data set at the time, but we'd come up with this concept that you could jam pack everything you possibly could into one plane and measure the top of the surface, the bottom of the surface, gravity and magnetics all at once. And I'll never do a technology development program again in Antarctica where I don't test it before I go to Antarctica. That's one of the learned lessons.
So it was field tested.
Oh, it was field tested. It was totally field tested, which meant that, you know, the first year we got one line of data and the second year we collected, you know, one degree of data. You know, we flew 111 square kilometer. So on the very last flight of the season, so it was totally dramatic. It's like, you know, we have to, they're never going to let us back. We've been out here 2 years. You know, they think we have not learned nothing from this new approach. And
do you mean NSF, the funders wouldn't?
Oh, well, yeah. You know, it was the funders. It was the community. It was, you know, often when you do these things, you're doing them because the community doesn't always agree with where you're going. I mean, I found that with the Dome Gamperts of Mountain Project, too. But this one, we were at the end of the season, and the plane landed, and the guys came running in, and they said, you won't believe what we saw. We saw a hole in the surface and a giant magnetic anomaly and something peaky on the radar. And it's like, oh, my gosh, I think that's a volcano. And then we sat down to think about it. The only way to make the hole in the surface was to be melting the bottom. So, no, it was one of those moments, you know, really discovery moments at what seemed to be the brink of of maybe not things going so well.
Did you know that theoretically there should be volcanoes under the Antarctic ice sheet?
Well, we'd been writing, you know, that with this integrated view, we should be able to see what was underneath. And certainly volcanoes were on the list of things that could be found. But did I really think we'd actually find one? I'd actually been poring over the MODIS data and looking for sort of dots and holes. And this actually, you know, the MODIS data was very early at that point. And I thought there was a depression there. But, you know, would you have been able to convince anybody? Probably not.
So you've had what looks like a pretty amazing success over the years. You have over 20 NSF proposals funded. When you're going to a funding agency with something like this, where you have kind of high risk outcomes and untested technologies, how do you pitch it?
Well, sometimes you try and get the community behind it. You know, that's one of the real parts of science, is often you'll pitch something and it doesn't fly the first time. And then, as I often say, you get the booby prize, which is you get the ability, the money, instead of to do the science, you get the money to run a workshop. And that's what very much what we did with the Lake Vostok work. We pitched it once, it didn't work, but then we ran a workshop. David Carl and I from Hawaii ran one. And that's where the community really came together the first time and put together a science plan on how to study subglacial lakes. And with that in place, the argument for going to Lake Vostok was much cleaner and flew that time. And similarly with going to the Gimberts of Mountains. Carol Finn and I had been sort of scheming that one up for a couple of years, and it just wasn't going very far. And but once it became very clear that it could be done internationally and with under the framework of the International Polar Year, then that was its opportunity. You know, you got the international community behind it. So it's the concept that you can't just have an idea, but you sometimes have to work to make the idea better and work with the community.
So you have to think strategically and take advantage of things like the IPY as a kind of a hook to get the rest of the community interested.
Right. That one was interesting. I was very much involved in planning the IPY, and I hadn't necessarily thought I was going to launch a huge program. And then it became very clear that everybody kept on saying the Gimberts of Mountains, the Gimberts of Mountains, and nobody was going to do it. It's like, okay, this is the time to move on this. It's like, there's this giant opportunity sitting there, and this is the moment to do it.
I think that for me, Antarctica is fascinating because it still has this potential for just discovering bizarre things that we didn't know existed, where the rest of the world is at least superficially, relatively well explored. And in Antarctica, you have up to several kilometers of ice still covering the bed. And you find things like the upward flow of water and the Gemberts or the subglacial lakes and the volcano. Is that part of why you're so keen on working in Antarctica? Or is it the broader issues about mass loss and sea level rise or all of us together in one combination?
I love the sense of discovery. I love, you know, I was the kind of kid who in the backyard would always be flipping over the flagstones to see what was underneath. And my job has kind of been flipping over the ice sheet to look at what's underneath. But what really drove me to Antarctica was the sense that the science I could do there mattered. You know, that it was basic science, but it mattered for the rest of the globe, and that has just becoming increasingly important and increasingly evident to more people than just me.
Do you mean from the sea level rise
from
perspective?
From the sea level rise perspective. I mean, when we published the volcano paper, we were still not really allowed or encouraged to say much about sea level, or it was still not front and center, and now it's just evident that we as a species need to understand how the ice sheets work. We know the satellites have very clearly demonstrated to us that the ice sheets are changing, but we need to understand the hows and whys so we know what's going to happen in the future.
One of the most amazing things to me about the findings that you've come out with in Greenland, but also in Antarctica, is just the character of ice and ice rheology. I guess I have a question, which is a ridiculous question, but one I really wondered about a lot is how do you personally conceptualize ice? So to you, what is ice?
Oh, first of all, I spend all my time walking around. Whenever I go somewhere, I look, okay, is this, what would this, how could have ice made these terrains we're walking by? Or, you know, what did this look like when it was covered with ice? So I spent a lot of time looking, thinking about what it would happen if ice had been here. Then I spend a lot of time actually looking at models and things. I've dragged my nephews into making layers and layers of chocolate, different white and dark chocolate, to make mini ice sheets, and then we can cut them to see what they look like.
This is nominally a project for your nephews, but really it's for you.
Everybody knows it's for me. It's not for me. Nobody's. And sometimes we try beeswax. Anyway, you know, so I spend a lot of time trying to figure out what's the best way to show people what an ice sheet looks like, just because they're so big, they're so beautiful, and I worry they're good. People think they're kind of scary when, in fact, we're the ones that are scary, and the ice sheets are simply gorgeous. So that's how I conceptualize it, everything from how did it make the landscapes around me to how is it like chocolate?
I was thinking it's kind of like a very cold pudding, mm-hmm. in a sense, because what amazed me was seeing the radar images that you show where you have what looks like ice convection going on or ice mixing that could be caused by this basal freeze-on process. Can you talk a little bit about what you thought when you initially saw this and then what's come out with you and your collaborators and trying to understand the physical principles that are driving that? And then finally, what are the implications for ice core drilling and past climate interpretation?
Right. Well, this was one of the wonderful things that came out of the trip to the Gambritsev Mountains. And some of it was, you know, quite frankly, we'd been scooped in terms of the beautiful morphology we discovered, you know, and that the Sun Bo and the Chinese team had published that, you know, it looked dendritic. And, oh my God, we just saw it. Every time we flew, we'd get a bigger picture of this. But at the same time, if you read the logs of the people who were flying, they were seeing things it didn't look like what they thought they should be seeing. When you look at radar.
Always a good sign.
Yeah, always a good sign. You know, they were seeing these pointy mountains, which is what we expected. And then they were seeing the nicely layered, you know, layers of chocolate or layers of ice on top. But then they were seeing these things that weren't behaving the way we expected the ice sheet to do. And yeah, there were comments like, this looks like a giant dental x-ray or a huge off-axis reflector, or, you know, you could just, I actually have it in a presentation I show just to convey to people that we were seeing weird things in the field, but we were at a really high altitude and, you know, maybe people were a little dopey. they were really tired.
You mean the pilots?
No, I mean the scientists. We were at high elevation and there wasn't much oxygen. And, you know. So we came back and we started to, you know, it was one of these classic tensions in science was, should we just make the maps and publish the maps, or should we chase this weird thing we saw? And it, again, was one of those moments where it was the integration of the data that suddenly, I can remember standing around the table with some graduate students and engineers and some British colleagues and putting together the radar and where we thought there was water and what the map at the bottom of the ice looked like. And it's like, oh my, look, these things are associated with water. Oh my, they're coherent. I think this is the story we should be chasing. That this is not, you know, sure we can make maps of the mountains, but this is something different. So that was a pretty cool process. I still have the giant fence diagram of fence diagrams where you take vertical slices and put them together so you can sort of peer down on them. So that was fun, particularly because we were told by some colleagues that we were not going to find anything interesting in the Gambritsev Mountains.
That's always good motivation too, I suppose.
Right, right. To be told you're wasting everybody's money and stopping good real science. So then we figured out that we could map the waters in the valleys and that the water seemed to be running uphill to feed these freeze-on sites. That happened, as I like to think, as the cirques, or if there were ski areas in the Gambritsev Mountains, this is where the parking lots would be for the ski areas. The freeze-on was happening and making, you know, 1,000 meters of new ice. So it was just one of those, you know, it was kind of like the volcano. It was like, wow. We've gone somewhere new and looked in a way that that's what exploration and discovery is going somewhere new or looking at something in a way nobody else has looked at it before. And then when the data started coming back from Greenland and I realized that the structures looked the same, you know, that, suggesting that the ice didn't behave like a nice layered flat medium, that there was lots of complex processes going on at the bottom.
So when you showed that work to ice scoring people, or even when I saw it for the first time, my immediate thought was, oh, what does that mean about the age models for the ice cores? What does the ice core community think about this? Are they viewed as being a pervasive issue that they need to worry about? I know it, like in the Neem core, they had these issues for the last interglacial about the persistent folding, and they used a method synchronization approach to try and develop an age model for that. But do you think that this kind of freeze on from below, and then these big cells of moving ice have major implications for the age models that are attached to the ice cores?
Well, it's clearly a problem when you look at the Neem Corps, and you realize that they found the Eemian three times, twice upside down. So clearly the bottom of the ice sheet isn't, you know, is deforming and folding. And Dorda and I have talked about this a lot. Dorda's the lead, Dahl Jensen is the lead scientist on much of the Neem work, and is actually coming here to Lamont next week to serve on a committee of my graduate student who's finishing. So we talk about this a lot, on whether or not it's rheology in the ice that's causing this, or whether it's water at the base, or whether it's what actually is making the ice sheet deform. So it really, it clearly matters, and it is, means we have to be much more careful on where we select our ice core sites, or we have to embrace it and accept that maybe it means that we've kicked older ice up higher into the ice sheet, and maybe that ice, that Eemian ice, actually is shallower than we thought it would be, so maybe we can sample it more easily. So those are the kind of things that Dorda and I'm sure we'll be talking about next week.
So you mentioned that ice rheology is an alternate explanation. Can you discuss what ice rheology is and how it could explain those phenomena?
The question is, what makes these big turned over features in the ice sheet? And probably the three possible interpretations are freezing from the bottom, which is what the evidence looks pretty strong for as happening in the Gimberts of Mountains. Deformation because of changing slip at the bottom. So basically a piece of ice slams into the piece of ice in front of it and deforms and warms itself. Or that it's inherent because different age ice has different size crystals and will behave differently when it's deformed. So it's that different behavior when it's deformed, which is the rheology hypothesis. And it's probable that all three are active in different places. And to me, it just comes back to this question that we still don't understand exactly how ice sheets work, because there are these dynamic processes at the bottom that aren't really included in our ice sheet models that are, we use to predict the future.
It seems like the ice sheet models that we have available today are probably a long ways off from being able to include those kind of processes. Is that your perception as well? Or do you see, are there people that are actually working on that?
Oh, I think that, you know, they are starting to think about how to better include these kind of processes into the ice sheet models. But I think it's an iterative process. I think that the community studying ice sheets has been relatively small. And a lot of the results have come from space. And with space, you can only really look at the surface. And that to see really what's going on, we need to look within the ice sheet and then what's going on at the bottom. I mean, that's sort of what I've learned over the years, is that you can learn a lot from the surface, but the insides of the ice sheets is going to tell you a lot about what's going on now and its history of what's happened to that hunk of ice as it's flowed along.
Looking back over your career, your ideas, and your papers, I'm really struck by the degree to which you have to have both, I don't know what to call it exactly, but big ideas about how the system works, but also the ability to get down in the nuts and bolts of the technological development. And can you talk just a little bit about what kinds of technology, aerogravity, radar, you're using? What are those processes? How do they work, and how have they changed over the years?
I always say what got me into Antarctic science was the ability to measure gravity on a small plane, which nobody had done before. And that came out of a funding opportunity Lamont had, where they gave small bits of money. Actually, not so small. It was very generous. It was $15,000, which 25 years ago was a lot. And I basically took the gravity meter off the ship, because the ship was in shipyard, and put it on an airplane. And demonstrated both I could do it in Antarctica from a P3 and from a small plane flying up and down the Long Island Sound. And that basically opened the doors to this sort of ability to put multiple instruments on an aircraft at the same time. So measuring the gravity tells you the density of what's underneath the ice sheet, and can also be used as a proxy for topography. So that was really my entry into it, was that of bringing new technology to the table is, again, that sort of how we explore and discover, by looking at things in a different way or going somewhere and measuring things people haven't measured before. And over the years, I've assemble the suite of instruments to use both from big airplanes and small airplanes that both use laser to measure the ice surface and increasingly cameras, visual and infrared, to measure surface processes. And then radars to look both shallow and deep, shallow radars looking at the accumulation of the snow, the very shallow layers, and then the deep sounding radar to measure the thickness. And then gravity to measure the density and magnetics to measure the magnetic signature of the rocks below. So it's really that integration that I first did on a Twin Otter, or my very first experience were on a Subchaser, a P3, and then on a Twin Otter that we used in the Gamberts of Mountains. It's kind of like a bush pilot's plane, sits about 18 people, works on skis. And now we've gone to sort of modularized approach where we're again using long range aircraft. The New York Air National Guard C-130 is what we'll be using this year, but this time gramming most everything into a pod that clamps on the outside of the plane.
This is your ice pod project?
This is the ice pod project that came out of the fact that it was so hard to put all those people up at elevation in the Gamberts of Mountains. And we were all done. The New York Air National Guard people came up to me and said, you know, if we'd been able to put your instruments on our plane, we could have done it all from McMurdo without having to put everybody at high altitude. Because at Vostok,
that's quite compelling.
Oh, it is very compelling, because at Vostok we had 7 medevacs because of the elevation. I mean, Antarctica's
7,
yeah, including somebody who was, you know, very, they didn't think was going to live. So it was kind of compelling, you know, wow, if I can do this from one of these big planes, you don't have to do the same heroics with the people and heroics moving fuel and stuff into the interior. As beautiful as the interior of Antarctica is, I mean, it's like being at sea. You look at this big sky and it's blue and the ice sheet is white, but it's not necessarily very good for people and is such a narrow window to work in.
Talking about the Ross ice shelf, I know that this is an enormous ice shelf, sort of the size of France. It's extremely thick. There has been work in the Andrel program there showing these pretty enormous and shocking cycles in whether it was there or not. And I know that ice shelves are important for buttressing ice streams. What are you trying to tackle specifically in the Rosetta project?
Specifically, it is an integrated project where we're doing some tectonics, some oceanography, some glaciology all together. The simple one-liner is we're trying to map the ice shelf and the ocean floor underneath. The ocean floor is, as you said, the size of France, but it's the least known piece of ocean floor on our planet because we have measurements every 50 kilometers. And all the maps make it look really flat.
And it's not.
It's not. We flew 2 lines over it last year and we inverted the gravity and it's pretty rough under there. So we're pretty excited that we're going to find a much more rugged terrain that will both provide places for the ice shelf to pin. Sort of the ice sheet can slow itself down when it advances from its teeth. And there'll probably be deeper spots where there's other avenues for warming ocean water to get to the edge of the West Antarctic ice sheet.
With something as big as the Ross, I'm imagining that you don't have one pinning point that spans the entire embayment or one area where you might have increased ocean mixing. That's going to be kind of a combination of these processes going on simultaneously all over the place. Is that the case, or do you have more homogeneous features?
Well, right now, all the models think it's pretty homogeneous because of this 50-kilometer line spacing. And our first glance at the test data last year demonstrates there are several deep paths that cut across the ice shelf, we think. You know, we don't have much data, but our quick peek makes us think that there are several deep draws and there are several very shallow places. So it's going to be another wonderful chance to pull back the ice sheet and look what's underneath it. And we'll understand better how the West Antarctic rift system is formed because everybody has merely drawn dotted lines across that region based on this 50-kilometer space data, which is better than nothing, but is very coarse.
And then would these troughs that you have seen so far be carved out by previous advances of the ice sheet itself?
That's our current guess, is that somewhere underneath the Ross Ice Shelf, we have to go from somewhere where it's carved to where it's depositing out in the out on the shelf. We know there are great big deposits, and we know that Andril has drilled deposits that were from, but we'll have to see where that boundary is and how the system works.
I remember reading a couple of papers on this, I think a few years ago, and the idea kind of seemed to be that when you have a major ice sheet advance on these carving out of these troughs, the ice sheet is essentially planting the seeds of its own demise, because those are then the pathways through which you might have the warmer waters coming back up to destabilize the base of the ice shelves. Is that kind of the feedback loop that might be taking place?
Well, it might be. As I tell people, we think it's so smooth right now that we don't have a sense that there are these deep channels, but our sample spacing is so we could hide the Grand Canyon in there, which would be a lovely deep trough to convey water in there. But we could also hide the White Mountains or the Green Mountains under there, which would be lovely pinning points. So yes, the ice sheet has, I think the past ice sheets have been much more active in terms of modifying the terrain underneath the Ross Ice Shelf than we've thought.
It's fun to speculate. And another area that isn't really speculation, but it's fascinating to me and ties in with your own earlier work on the volcano under the ice sheet, is this idea that variations in global ice volume are coupled to things like rifting, ocean rifting, and also hotspot volcanism, and that those then control or strongly influence atmospheric CO2 levels. I know this is a bit out of your main area of interest, but there's interactions with your work. Have you been following this line of research that was sort of suggesting a major feedback from ice volume onto volcanism and then CO2 and
the
climate?
The one I have looked at is the concept that there's a feedback between ice sheet ocean loading and mid-ocean ridge morphology, which I found a little surprising. Because every time, what do you think I would do? I'd go pull up data and look at it. And because if this was true, you'd expect to see a very clear change from when in the... So basically, this is the concept that the ice sheets should be driving the formation of the abyssal hills on the bottom of the ocean floor, because they're controlling magma and faulting coming out, because the ocean loading. And to me, the whole question was, well, if this is the case, then you should see a shift between the 40,000 to the 100,000 cycle. And I went and quickly, I couldn't see anything in my quick look at pulling some profiles up. And I think there's just been a paper came out. I know one of my colleagues here, Roger Buck, was on it. So we've talked about it a lot. And really not being clear that at least on the mid-ocean ridge scale that you can drive it, that it's not obvious that it's there in the data. So I have thought about it. I haven't spent a lot of time with my head on looking at that whole cycle. But sometimes some parts of this loop aren't necessarily there. Well, it's very clear that in Iceland there's a link between ice loading and volcanism.
So interesting, but the jury's perhaps still out on the broader applications.
Yeah, that's what I would say, is the jury's still out, and I didn't buy the initial story. It was it was one of these things. It's an idea. It was based on not an awful lot of data. That's sort of something Lamont prides itself in, is, when you come here, you see that this is a place that a lot of the data that plate tectonics was based on was collected here, and there's that heritage, and then there's the core lab, which is where much of paleoceanography and the whole concept of changing climates came from. And so this is the go-to question usually is here: what does the data look like, and does it really support that idea, or how can you prove it with some evidence?
So Lamont has a high tolerance for risky ideas over the years.
Yes, yes.
Just fantastic.
Yes, but there's also always the question of how are you going to test that idea?
And of course, you're all in, I believe, soft money. So there's, I guess there's a point at which you need to bring that evidence to bear.
Right. The fact that much of this institution is run on soft money really moves it forward and forces people to be nimble. is the way I think about it. It's, you know, being on soft money encourages people to be nimble intellectually and willing to move in new directions.
I talked with Bjorn Stevens from the Max Planck Institute, and he has the perception that at the MPI in their system, you invest in big hires of people in labs, and then you essentially turn them loose and give them a rather long leash to develop their ideas. So there's, and that system produces also great ideas, but the Lamont system is, and it's sort of entirely different, but in some ways it tends to produce, I think from both ways, equally interesting outcomes. Do you think that it really depends on the personality of the scientist in which one they might do better or find more stimulating?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. People always ask me, you know, how do you find life on soft money? And it's like, well, you know, all the research shows that if you look at the women who are happiest, it's usually women running their small business. And I consider that I run a small business, and my business happens to be ideas about how our planet works. And that I have been, you know, very lucky to be in a place where that's the currency, is ideas and data and questioning how things work and testing your ideas, see if they're right or wrong.
Speaking of women in science and small businesses, you were also involved in the advanced program at Lamont. Can you talk about the insights that you gained that might be specific to Lamont, and then more broadly, how your thinking has evolved about women in science?
Women in earth sciences has been a challenge over the years. You know, when I first came here, there were I think one woman on the senior staff and no women on the faculty.
Out of how many?
Oh, 26 on the faculty and 60 on the research staff. So it wasn't a very gender diverse environment.
In 1982, there were no women on the faculty. Yeah. That is for diversity.
Yeah. So I worked with Mark Kane on this, who actually went south during the civil rights era on the buses. And we felt like this was really a chance to get NSF to help improve this environment. And that's how NSF was looking at it, was that you didn't need to – it wasn't an individual problem. It was a systemic environment. We needed to look at the ecosystem as a whole. And it was probably much harder than anything else I'd done. I mean, running a field program in Antarctica was a piece of cake compared to trying to get people to think about diversity and reflect on how they make their own decisions. People don't like to do that. But with scientists, you have to approach it as a science. You had to bring the science of diversity to the table. And it was fascinating. We managed to change the population from single digits on both the research and the teaching faculty line to double digits. We managed to help improve the line of the soft money scientists here in general. So it was a huge experiment. It worked. It was hard, though.
And it was hard because the default position of scientists is not introspection on these kinds of issues?
It's hard because two things. One is, when you raise the issue, it sounds like you're blaming men, and you aren't really blaming men. You're blaming us all. We all make decisions.
But it might generate a defensive reaction.
That was challenging. And then it got to be much more individual issues as pushing a system-wide change. And getting into individual people and individual problems was a challenge, much harder than I thought it would be. But, you know, I'm proud of it. I'm proud I did it. And it's interesting. I do see the next generation is willing to stand up to things that my generation would have been willing to stand up. My daughter, it's interesting to watch the next generation, and my daughter will take no guff. She's having watched this through her childhood. She is very well posed to identify any issues and address them right away.
You mentioned that you had to medevac seven people out of Vostok because of elevation sickness. And I can imagine that in Antarctica, in these long field campaigns, there are a lot of other issues that could potentially arise in terms of sexual harassment, or I don't even want to call it hostile work environment is the euphemism that would be used now. And with the kind of thing that you're coming out about UC Berkeley and the astronomy department there. I'm just curious, have there been similar issues in geoscience in Antarctica, or has it been a totally different environment?
Fieldwork is challenging in anywhere, and it's certainly challenging in Antarctica. When I first went to Antarctica, I was often the only woman principal investigator on the ice, and the first year I was the only woman in the field camp. The next year I made sure I hired and brought some women and made sure, encouraged the other groups to diversify. But there was, I had some employees who had issues. You know, things have gotten better as people have been more willing to recognize what's going on and address it. So I can't say that Antarctic science has been without its challenges that way.
But overall, do you see an improvement
in the climate? Yes, overall I see an improvement in the climate. I mean, when, as a graduate student, Carol Raymond, who is now in charge of small bodies at JPL and has a satellite, she's co-investigator on the Dawn mission around Ceres, and she was just picked to put an instrument on the Europa mission, she and I would be often mistaken for secretaries in the field. Yeah, so that doesn't happen anymore. That's the wonderful thing, is that we see many more women leading programs. It just, last year in Antarctica, it just gave me such pleasure to watch the young women scientists doing remarkable things. It was just when I would watch them run across the lab and moving stuff in helicopters and having it slung loaded across places and figuring out how to drill through the Wizard project. It was just, it was a thing of beauty. It's like, yes, there has been change, and these women are moving forward and doing kick-ass science.
That must be incredibly fulfilling and gratifying to see that happen over the course of 20, 30 years.
Right.
That's amazing.
If this wasn't a podcast, you'd see this big, silly smile on my face. It just makes me so happy to see these women. And I'm very happy. You know, I'm not going in the field this with the Rosetta Project. I'm sending one of the young women down to be the lead scientist because she's totally capable of doing it. And I want to make sure the next generation is there and fully ready to go to understand how the ice sheets are changing.
Something else you've done in terms of scientific leadership is you've been on multiple National Academy reports. You've testified in front of the Senate. You're now head of the AGU Cryospheric Sciences section, but you've also been involved in an incredibly large number of committees. And I'm curious if that level of engagement, involvement in this wide swath of committees and outreach activities is just your natural inclination, or did you see it as something that you had to do in order to get to where you wanted to be in science? Thinking back about your earlier comments about how you're able to move forward work by being involved in the IPY, for example. And is that just sort of a great fit for your personality, or did you have to kind of force yourself to do this kind of engagement?
The engagement's a lot of work, and it's certainly been wear on my family because it adds a lot of travel. But I feel like that's part of how we are able to do science that's bigger than our individual ideas. You know, all the research shows that our ideas are better when we share them in the on the larger scale we share them, the better the ideas get. So part of that, serving on committees, has very much been in my belief that it's a critical part of the science process. I try and pick one at a time. Like when I got to be chair of the Polar Research Board at the National Academy, I really decided that, you know, I had an opportunity to push for the International Polar Year, and so we held a workshop to see if it was a good idea. And it's like, well, it was going to be awfully boring if it was a party, but it looked like there was a chance to do cutting-edge science. And so it was a venue to do it. So that's what I see these committees as being, as a way to bring the science community together and to be able to do more than we can as individual.
It seems like the community working together, as you've been talking about, is now saying that maybe mass loss from Antarctica is something like 80 gigatons a year, with a lot of uncertainties and big range in that, and that the multimillennial sea level rise could be anywhere from sort of 50 centimeters up to many meters of sea level rise. And thinking broadly about your work, what's coming up in your work in the ROS and then interactions with the modeling community, where do you think we have the most opportunity to bring those uncertainties down? Or are there really other big picture questions that we should be thinking about that aren't getting the proper attention?
I really think that there are sort of three things we should be looking at. And we're trying at Lamont to start a Changing Ice, Changing Coastline initiative. And we're really focused on three things: how much and how fast sea level went up in the past. We know sea level has gone up in the past. And really the question is how much and where did it go up? And so that's really the paleo question. And then there's the present, where I think we know that ice sheets are changing, but we don't understand the processes. We don't understand the drivers, and we don't understand the internal dynamics of the ice sheets. So I see that as a second. So there's paleo, there's what's going on now, whether it's surface mass balance or whether it's basal processes. These are things we don't understand well enough yet. And then the third one is in figuring out how to put our insights from those two observational processes so we can foster better models of the future projections. This also came out in the recent National Academy of Report on what the future directions for Antarctic and Southern Ocean science should be. So I feel like we're still discovering things. We're still understanding things, for example, the fact that the ocean's not a bathtub and there's the gravitational effect. I just love that. You know, it just shows how there were things that, you know, 8 years ago we wouldn't really have thought of. I have pictures that I published 8 years ago that are like, I still use, but they're really totally wrong because of this gravitational effect. So it just shows there's so much left to be done. And really starting with the past, looking at the present, and using it to better understand the future is, I think, the direction we have to go.
Robin Bell from Columbia University and Lamont, working towards bringing together paleo sea level rise mechanism and insights into models. Thank you so much for the conversation.
It's a pleasure talking with you.